Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Western powers are still all in for Ukraine, and F-16 fighter jets are finally on the table. But will the rest of the world go along with the plan? Let's get to the bottom line. Ukraine and China were high on the agenda in the Group of Seven meeting in Hiroshima, Japan last week. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was invited, and he got a promise from U.S. President Joe Biden to allow training on American-made F-16s, which is probably a first step toward getting those fighter jets to Ukraine. Up until now, the U.S. didn't want to send those weapons to Ukraine for fear of escalating the war, because they can hit targets deep inside Russian territory. The G7 attacked China for using so-called economic coercion to force countries to bend to its will, and China responded by calling the G7 as a, quote, exclusive bloc that's not representative of most of the world. So where is the Western agenda heading? And can the G7 set the agenda for the whole world without serious pushback from the global south? Does the G7 really even matter anymore? Today we're talking with Ian Bremmer, president and founder of the Eurasia Group, which studies political risk around the world, and he's the author of a great book, The Power of Crisis. Ian, thank you so much for talking to us today about G stuff, as I call it, G7, G0, G2, whichever Gs we have. But we just had a G7 meeting in Hiroshima, and I would love to get a snapshot from you right now on whether you think this meeting was relevant to any of us.
It's very relevant, and the G7 has become much more cohesive, much more united, in part because we are living in a G0 world, because there is an absence of global leadership and the presence of threat and crisis geopolitically. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, the Chinese government becoming much more economically powerful, but not aligned with the United States or its allies in political or economic system. Those are things that are deeply concerning to the advanced industrial democracies, the principal members of the G7. And you saw that on display in Hiroshima. You saw that with the invitation of Zelensky and his personal sit-down meetings with every single one of them, and the extraordinary amount of economic support and military support that's being provided. You also saw it with the greater cohesiveness in concern about economic coercion, as the G7 puts it, from China, and greater alignment of U.S. and other G7 countries in their China policies, their security policies, increasingly their industrial policies in some areas of the economy. So in that regard, the G7 is very important. Final point, though, of course, Biden had to cut short his dinner meeting at the G7 with the heads of state and then canceled the rest of his trip. Why? Because of political dysfunction in your town, Steve, in Washington, D.C., and the debt limit crisis that is not yet resolved and very quickly approaching.
So is this feeling to you like a Cold War? Because it stands out to me that right now China's the world's second largest economy. India is the fifth. The BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, are planning their own summit soon, and 19 other countries want to join up with them. Are we seeing the world divide itself between the G7 pals of the United States and everyone else?
I think the answer to that is no. I mean, look, there is, unfortunately, there's much worse than a Cold War between the G7 and Russia. It's a hot war. It's just being fought largely by proxy. And of course, the fact that even F-16s are being provided going forward, and even 3 months ago, Biden said that could be tantamount to World War III, shows you just how the gloves are off. But on China, there is a recognition, and you saw this from Janet Yellen, Secretary of Treasury, just a few weeks ago giving a speech for the U.S., and you saw this from Biden over the weekend saying he thought U.S.-China relations would improve, but from a low base. That there is a recognition of interdependence between the G7 and China, between the U.S. and China. The term of art is now de-risking, but not decoupling. In other words, U.S. and China today have more trade than at any time with each other, than at any time in history. And while that doesn't sound like a Cold War, and if the Americans did want a Cold War, none of the American allies would want it. And of course, India, you mentioned, is in the BRICS, but India is also in the Quad. And all of those developing countries, many of them have very good security relations with the U.S., but they have very strong economic relations with China. So it's a lot more complicated than just saying Cold War 2.0. But there certainly is no trust between the United States and China today. And there's increasingly very little trust between the G7 and China, given that these are the two largest economies in the world. That's not a comfortable position to be in.
You know, with no offense towards Papua New Guinea, which I love, I don't think many Americans had any idea President Biden was scheduled to go there until he canceled the trip to Papua New Guinea and also to Australia. And we've since learned that Papua New Guinea has agreed to become a site of American naval bases. And it raises this question of whether this encirclement strategy of laying out bases, military capacity, alliances, you know, around China, which is a Chinese paranoid fear, is actually something they should be fearful about. What are your thoughts on the military encirclement of China by the United States and its allies and Papua New Guinea?
We need to recognize that China today is the dominant trade partner economically for a large majority of all the countries in the world. And that does not mean that the Americans are being encircled economically. It just means that China has a strong and robust economy that the state is driving, and they are investing outwardly everywhere. And they'll be the largest economy in the world probably by 2030, 2032. The United States is the dominant military power in the world. The U.S. outspends the next 10 countries in the world in defense, the next 10 countries combined. Okay. So, I mean, if that's true, if the Americans are that far ahead of everyone else in military spending, then of course, the majority of military bases out there are going to be American. And what's going to happen is that countries around the world will be more aligned with the United States on direct national security matters, and they'll be more aligned with the Chinese on economic matters, and that will be messy. That will be messy. But that is not a Cold War, and it's also not encirclement, because the fact of American military dominance is not in any way preventing the Chinese from having these extraordinarily robust economic relations. It just so happens that Chinese power is primarily expressed through their trade and commercial relationships, not surprising for a state capitalist political system, while the American influence and power is partially ideological, but frankly, that's been weakened a lot given dysfunction at home in the United States. A lot more of it is about its military presence and dominance. So this should not be startling to anyone that pays attention to the league tables and which countries do what.
You know, one of the things that's confusing me right now about Chinese relations with the West are mixed signals. So on one hand, you have the summit about concerned about Chinese economic coercion in the world, also trying to sort of wrangle, if you will, basically try to prevent major investment by the West in Chinese capacity in high-tech areas and quantum and AI and others. But on the other hand, you've got Joe Biden comes out and says, you know, we're going to see a thaw in these chilly relations. You're going to see a lot of our cabinet officials meeting their counterparts with China and trying to basically take the U.S.-China relationship into a warmer track than the cold one it's been on since the spy balloon. So what's going on?
Well, in the same, you had just asked me in your last question, hey, should the Chinese be worried about military encirclement? When the Americans and the G7 talk about Chinese economic coercion, it is the same concern. Mm. It's just from a different lens, because the Americans don't have the ability to do global economic policy through the state. They can't build a Belt and Road the way the Chinese can, and the Chinese can't build credible military bases around the world or a defense export strategy the way the Americans can. And it turns out that that reality makes both countries kind of uncomfortable. But despite that, the Americans and the Chinese both see that they need each other and that that need is not going to go away. So just as there's a lack of trust and just as there's concern on the economic and military side, you also have both countries wanting to meet and wanting to talk about those areas where there can be a level of greater cooperation and that there is a level of greater cooperation. I mean, the trade relationship is enormous cooperation. We just don't talk about it because the politics are so dysfunctional. climate, clearly both sides would like to see more. Global economic stability, the reaction to the mini banking crisis, the Americans and the Chinese don't want that to blow up. And by the way, even the debt limit. I mean, Putin, I am sure, would love to see the debt limit blow up in the faces of Biden and U.S. political leaders. The Chinese don't want to see that because the Chinese don't want a severe U.S. recession, that because they're so dependent on the properly well-functioning of a global economy where the U.S. is the largest participant. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that both the Americans and the Chinese would like a relationship that is more stable than the politics are presently driving it.
I mean, you're describing a situation in which two adversaries or rivals are joined at the hip and are mutually dependent on each other's, you know, survival, not just survival, but actually needing to thrive. But it raises another interesting question. You know, I'm sure you read every word President Biden says, just like I do. And when he was in Hiroshima, he talked about a company, Micron, a chip maker that has R&D facilities, production facilities in Hiroshima, Japan. So I wake up, and guess what? China has now declared Micron as not having met its security tests, and it is now banning Micron from all of its infrastructure. What are the implications there? Is this just a play around Huawei and what we've been doing to basically target Huawei, and this is their response? Or do you suspect there are now deeper measures that China is going to take about a more adversarial treatment of American tech products?
Well, first of all, you're right in terms of adversaries or competitors joined at the hip. The way I like to think of it are parents where the love has left the relationship. They're married still and they have kids. And no matter what they think of each other, they both really love the kids and they don't want to screw the kids up. And so as a consequence, they're going to take measures and they're going to act in ways that help ensure that the kids aren't mistreated, that they can still grow. And, you know, that's not easy to do when the love has left a family relationship. But there is, I think, a level of recognition. Now, the Americans have levied export controls on a number of high-end semiconductors that the U.S. considers to be dual use. In other words, useful for economics and military purposes. The Chinese, in response, have levied sanctions against Micron. And Micron does not produce the same high-end advanced chips that TSMC in Taiwan does, the difference being that China has other sources for those same chips as the American company, Micron. And the Americans have already told the South Koreans, who provide some of those chips to China, hey, you should join with us in not providing those chips because the Chinese are hitting us. And, you know, the danger is you don't want to go too far from dual-use technologies where there are legitimate national security concerns to broader containment policy on the economy, because then you end up hurting yourselves. You end up taking away from the interdependence of the U.S.-China relationship that not only ensures that you continue to behave in a civil fashion towards each other, but also creates more growth, more wealth, reduces the cost of goods. I mean, remember, those you asked me about Micron, but you could have asked me about the Trump tariffs on Chinese goods, consumer goods, which the Chinese then also levied in return against American goods. And who got hurt? The voters, the consumers in the United States, and the citizens in China who have to pay higher costs for their goods. But, you know, Biden has no way of undoing those tariffs, even though it would be good for the economy, because he knows that politically he would get hurt for it by the polls and of course, by the Republicans, by his opposition. So you do end up cutting off your nose to spite your face in some of these conversations.
And, of course, all of those are not particularly helpful when you're trying to wrestle down inflation, because they actually help contribute to inflation. Another question. Recently, I interviewed Robert O'Brien, the former national security advisor to President Trump. And, you know, this, along with the other fact that the House Select Committee on China recently did a war game exercise looking at a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, how it would go, what the U.S. could bring to bear. And guess what? China, the high cost, but China succeeded. The U.S. did not block that invasion. O'Brien told me that if there were a successful invasion of Taiwan, that no element of TSMC, the greatest semiconductor manufacturer in the world, would be intact. And I'm interested, as a direct quote, and I'm interested in what, you know, as you look at it, is this, you know, a basically a race where we're beginning to look at Churchill saying about the, you know, the French fleet, we're not going to allow that to fall into Nazi hands. Are we thinking about extreme scenarios that this is really about advanced chips and not letting China get control of that industry?
Well, so on the one hand, it's fairly obvious that if there's a fight over Taiwan and the Chinese are about to take the most strategically important company in the world for themselves, the Americans aren't going to sit there and say, oh, it's fine for you to have it. And that's leaving aside the flood of talent that would leave. So, yeah, I think it's pretty clear that it would be disrupted slash destroyed. I also think it's highly irresponsible for the former national security advisor of the U.S. to be opining on that topic in the same way that a sitting national security advisor should not be. In my view, I think you should sort of, if you're in a position to make that decision, you know, you should kind of keep that quiet because it only makes the relationship worse. Difference between an analyst and a policymaker. But in the war games I've been involved in between the U.S., China, and Taiwan, the way it usually plays out is not military confrontation because it's obvious to both sides that it would cause such damage economically, and rather the Chinese leveraging the power they have, as I've already mentioned to you, the economic power. And of course, Taiwan overwhelmingly is dependent on mainland China economically, just as they're dependent on the U.S. and Australia and others for their security. And so what that means is if you're China and you want to change the status quo, you put export controls on Taiwanese companies until they behave in ways that are more patriotic and loyal to the mainland. You take actions against Taiwanese CEOs. You say you're going to cut them off from mainland Chinese trade. And that way, you get vastly more influence over the behavior of the Taiwanese political system and of their economy without suddenly threatening war that you're probably going to have massive negative impact from.
Right. Ian, do you put much stock in the West's response to the China Belt and Road Initiative and what they call the Partnership for Global Infrastructure? Does that have any chance of meaning anything?
Nope. The United States is a capitalist free market economy. It does not drive significant private sector investment, and it doesn't do much public sector investment. So it is useful at the margins. There will be some, you know, high standard investments that help to move the needle in transition energy economies, for example, and some areas of high tech. But on balance, if the United States is going to have more influence around the so-called Global South, it will not be by competing in the areas where the Chinese are dominant, structurally dominant. It'll be in other areas.
I was recently in Warsaw, Poland, and also Tallinn, Estonia, at national security forums. And I have to say that among European friends, the feeling was pervasive, one of thanks to the United States for all it had done in Ukraine, but also frustration with what they saw as the Biden administration dithering on key weapons decisions and whatnot, and marshaling, you know, the support that Zelensky needs, they feel, to push Russia out of the picture. And they fear that America is designing what may become, or at least acquiescing to, a frozen conflict, something like North and South Korea. This was a pervasive view. And they said, in that world, Putin wins and the West loses. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, you said you were in Poland and in Latvia?
Estonia.
Estonia, Tallinn, yes, Estonia. And I would point out that those are two of the European countries that are most strongly aligned with defending Ukraine and more hawkishly disposed towards Russia than any of the other Europeans. It's the Baltic states, Poland, and the Nordics. Not so you weren't in France, you weren't in Germany, you surely weren't in Italy or Spain. And I'm saying that because I don't want people to think that that perspective you just gave is a broad European perspective. Mm. It is not. The European perspective is fairly divided. On military support for Ukraine, the Americans are, of course, doing more than any other country by a long margin. That's not surprising given America's power. But also the Americans are the ones that have been pushing, and they are more closely aligned with the countries you just mentioned, the ones I just mentioned. That's particularly true now because of Biden's willingness to support these Storm Shadow missiles coming from the UK, which is a precursor to the Americans providing ATACMS to Ukraine, Also, the willingness to train Ukrainian pilots on the F-16s, that's a precursor to providing F-16s and allowing other countries to. In other words, the gloves from the United States on providing military support to Ukraine are off. And you'll see that support, you will see military and security guarantees, and of course, you will also see economic support for reconstruction. And all of those things are meant as precursors for what will be, at some point, some form of negotiations between the Russians and the Ukrainians. And the Americans want the Ukrainians to be in a much stronger position, militarily, economically, and diplomatically, before they start engaging in negotiations. That's why the Americans have waited for the counteroffensive, and right. That's why the Americans are stepping up the military support they're providing for Ukraine. So right. I actually think the concerns that you have raised are diminishing, and as of the G7 in Hiroshima, and are likely to diminish over the course of what we hope will be a relatively successful Ukrainian counteroffensive.
Final question, Ian, and thank you so much for your candor in all of this, but I agree with you that the G7 is, as I've seen it, you haven't seen it this aligned in a long time. At the same time, it's concerns about China. It's very big concerns about Russia. Russia is now the most sanctioned country in the world. I don't even know what more you can sanction. They found 200 more ways to sanction Russia. What's remarkable to me is how easy it is in this world today to end run anything the G7 does. The Russian economy is resilient in the face of all this. China has its own forms of resilience. And it just brings me back to this question of how much traction does the G7 really have? And I say this in a world so respectful of you looking at the G0 realities out there. Do they fundamentally matter anymore when you can end
matter,
run?
They matter less. The G7 used to be it. The G7 used to run the world, and then the Russians were brought in after Soviet collapse, the G7 plus one, and that didn't work very well. Then you created the G20, the 20 largest economies, but they weren't aligned. So the G20 couldn't do very much. They didn't have the same ability to move the ball. So yes, the G7 still matters, and if you sanction the Russians so heavily, of course that means the gas can't go anywhere. It gets flared, because if the Europeans don't buy it, you can't build infrastructure anywhere else. But you can't do that on food, because they're important for the global south. You can't do that on oil, because others will buy it. And so it is more limited. And so if the G7 talks, people listen. But let's be clear that, you know, in a relatively short order, the BRICS are going to represent a larger percentage of the global economy than the G7 does. And that's even if you don't expand the BRICS, and you probably are going to expand the BRICS. So what does that mean? It's more complicated. And there's a lack of global leadership, and that's why I wrote about the G0 10 years ago.
I always learn from Ian Bremmer, who is president and founder of the Eurasia Group and author of The Power of Crisis. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? It was almost 80 years ago when the global pecking order was established, with the United States and its friends on top. Now that order is coming undone. Old arrangements like the Group of Seven, which started after the Arab oil embargo of 1973, sort of look like a relic from a museum. It's true that those countries represent half of the world's wealth today, but they've got only 10% of the world's people. Today, China is the world's second largest economy, and India is fifth, but they're not members. These days, China can veto progress on just about anything, and other countries like Brazil, India, and Russia, well, they can flex their muscles as well. It used to be that whatever the Western powers wanted became the rules of the world. Those days are really gone. Maybe we're heading to a G0 world where no country's in charge. Or maybe a G2 world where China and the U.S. set all the global deals. But the reality is the sun is setting on the G7 world. And that's the bottom line.